پریږم. My name is Jack Bershad, and I'm chairman of the Philadelphia region of the Middle East Forum. In a moment, our distinguished speaker for the evening, Brian Karsh, will be introduced. But before that, I wish to say a few words about the event and the man who made it possible. We are here this evening because of the vision and commitment of Bob Guzzardi. Where is Bob? Get up, Adam. Recently elected vice chairman, Bob has been a member of the Middle East Forum's Board of Governors for 3 years. In that time, he has become an integral part of the forum's efforts in Philadelphia and nationally. His incredible energy, and if you know Bob, you know the energy level is as high as anyone you've ever met. In fact, don't get too close to him. And his understanding of the Middle East has made him a forum leader. But more than that, he's someone who is kind, and that's only been exceeded by his generosity, for which we thank you, Bob. On behalf of the board, the staff, and all of you here this evening, we thank you, Bob, and welcome you to the podium to introduce the flying party.
Thank you, Jack, for those very, very kind and unexpected words. I really appreciate them. And it is really my privilege to be able to support and participate with the Middle East Forum. The Middle East Forum, led by its director, Daniel Pipes, has consistently displayed a deep grasp of issues such as the threats posed by militant Islamicism, Middle East studies in North America, and U.S. foreign policy. One example of the forum's ability to accurately predict events almost before they happen, to quote Charles Krauthammer, quote, during the decades when America slept, Pipes was among the very first to understand the dangers of Islamic radicalism. In his many writings, he identified it and explained its roots, including most notably Wahhabism, as practiced and promoted by Saudi Arabia, and warned of its plans to infiltrate and make war on the United States itself. There are many more examples I could give that would demonstrate both the value and the consistency of the forum's many projects, but it would take all night. There is another example worth mentioning. The Boston Globe wrote that had the world heeded Pipes' warning, September 11, 2001 would never have happened. It is exactly this type of reputation that recently led Daniel Pipes' presidential appointment to the board of the United States Institute of Peace. Further evidence of the Middle East Forum's vitality, the Forum's four web sites attract the highest number of visitors per site, providing Middle East-focused analysis, a significant achievement by any standard. And particularly, I bring to your attention Campus Watch, which is probably the most popular website because of its critique of American universities and their one-sided presentation of Middle East analysis. It is in this spirit that I encourage all of you this evening to support this forum's important activities. Such support will enable the Middle East Forum to continue making an impact on public policy and increasing the public's understanding of one of the least understood regions of the world and perhaps one of the most important. It is my great pleasure and really quite a privilege to introduce Ephraim Karsh tonight. I've been a reader of his for many, many years. Several years ago, I emailed him in England and was very pleased to carry on a short correspondence. And it has been my hope to be able to bring Dr. Karsh to the United States, and this is quite a thrill. Dr. Karsh is an internationally known expert on Middle East affairs, Soviet policy towards the Middle East, and European neutrality. He's a professor and head of Mediterranean studies at King's College, University of London. Currently, he is Moxon Visiting Professor of Modern Israel Studies at Harvard University. He's held positions at the Sorbonne, Columbia University, the London School of Economics, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies, and Tel Aviv University. A frequent television and radio commentator, he has published in many periodicals, including in the Middle East Forum, and commentary. Any of you who did not get commentary certainly should. Dr. Karsh wrote an article revisiting Israel's original sin, which was a refutation of the Benny Morris and the revisionist historian's view of Israel. And there's a terrific exchange in the December issue of commentary, which also contains an article called Among the Arabs, where Brian Karsh also participates. It is my great honor to introduce Dr. Karsh tonight, and I hope you will give him a warm welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. I guess after such introduction, every single day will be an anticlimax. I was asked before whether I'm going to talk about something happy, positive. Unfortunately, I could disappoint you. What I'm going to talk is about the state of Israel's relations with the Palestinians, the ongoing war of terror, euphemized as Second Intifada, why it happened, and what are the prospects. Just the other day, a group of Israelis headed by former minister Yossi Pelin signed an agreement in Geneva with a group of Palestinians, associates of Yasser Arafat, and this has already received the endorsement of many European states and is bound to be part of the political agenda in the coming years. I will refer to it a bit later. I personally just find it quite incredible how a person like Pelin, who has been dealing with Yasser Arafat and the PLO for more than 10 years, has been willing to buy the same second-hand car, despite the fact that there is no engine in this car, time and again. Despite the fact that they themselves realize that to a large extent that they are being cheated. In November 1993, a couple of months after the signing of the so-called Oslo Accords on the White House lawn, Yossi Pelin gave a revealing interview to one of the Israeli dailies, Maariv. And they spoke about Oslo, and they asked him what he thought would happen in the future, and Yossi Pelin said, look, the test of Oslo is not going to be an intellectual test, it's going to be a test of love. And the interviewer said, what do you mean? He said, look, if terrorism persists, then we fail. If terrorism stops, then of course Oslo is a big success. So the interviewer said, but terrorism is still going on, despite the fact that we are a couple of months after the signing of Oslo. And then Pelin said, no, let Arafat come back to the territory. Not come back, let Arafat come to the territory because he never lived there. Arafat was born in Egypt, never lived in Palestine. And let him come and establish his authority and the police forces. And we'll give him a few months or maximum a year or two. And if after this period we realize that terrorism is still around, then we must acknowledge that Oslo was a major failure. We have to renege on the agreement, and in the worst case scenario, we have to go back and reoccupy the territories. And this is what Yossi Pelin said in 1993. So the test of blood, as we all know, unfortunately, has been passed with glowing success from the Palestinian point of view. There have been, in the 20 years before Oslo, you had about 400 Israelis killed in terrorist attacks. In the 10 years since Oslo, you had four times as many, which means that the rate is eight times as high as before Oslo. And still, Pelin goes and renegotiates the deal with the same people. The problem of Pelin and his life, in my opinion, is, and this is something, by the way, that a person like Veleti or Shafat Arkabi, who was the head of Israeli intelligence and a professor at the Hebrew University, this is something that he noticed as early as the 60s. The problem with the Israeli left is that the people who supposedly show or pretend to display the greatest empathy for the Arabs, in fact, Three Arabs, if we use Arkady's terms, not mine, as subhumans. They never listen to them, they always assume they know better what they want, and therefore it doesn't matter really what the Arabs say, because we in Israel know better. Shimon Peres said, you know, a few years ago that in among Arabs, the world doesn't have the binding commitment it has among European or Western societies. Among Arabs, the world is largely a decoration. So if it's a decoration, I wonder what we're going to sign agreement to them, but never mind. I think this is the main issue. The fact of the matter is that if you go and read and follow what Arafat and his lieutenants have been telling their people over the past 20 years, I don't think you should be surprised today, because from the beginning of the Oslo process, Arafat told these people in no uncertain terms that basically Oslo was a deception designed to lead to the destruction of Israel. As a matter of fact, Arafat is much more consistent than this. I mean, he's been remarkably consistent as early as 1968. Shortly before he became the head of the PLO, he gave an interview to a German magazine, and he outlined the strategy of the PLO as he saw it, and the strategy was to move the resistance bases, as they call it, to the territories, to the West Bank and Gaza, and from there to conduct a sustained terrorist assault on Israel, to destroy the Israeli way of life, to destroy Israeli tourism, to undermine the Israeli economy, to undermine Israeli self-confidence, and eventually lead to the situation where Israelis will conclude that they cannot can live no longer in their state and leave. This was the strategy in 68. Now, the PLO realized in the late 60s, early 70s, that it couldn't achieve it. The population in the territories, the inside, as they are called by the Palestinians, was reluctant to cooperate with the PLO, which is mainly based on 48 refugees, and called the outside in the Palestinian jargon. They didn't want to cooperate with them, largely because under Israeli control, the standard of living in the Palestinian territory has increased substantially. I mean, when Israel arrived in 67, the life expectancy was 48 years old. 48 years, and when Israel left in 93, it was 72, and so on and so forth. And on top of it, of course, the Israeli security services were quite efficient. So the PLO recognized they cannot transfer the resistance base to the territory, so in 1974 they adopted what they called the phase strategy. And the phase strategy said that despite the fact that armed resistance, that is terrorism, remains the foremost instrument to liberate Palestine, and then resort to political means as well. And if Israel were to give them any part of the territories it occupied in 67, they'd take it, establish a Palestinian authority on it, and then continue the struggle until the complete liberation of Palestine. This is the first strategy of 1974, from which the PLO has never really wavered. Now, when Arafat eventually signed the Oslo Accords in 1993, in very difficult position, don't forget that the PLO was on the verge of extinction in the early 90s because of his siding with Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War. The Gulf states suspended the military, the financial support. No Arab leader was willing to talk to Arafat. Had the Israeli government not come and initiated talks with the PLO in Oslo, the PLO would have been a success. It would have disappeared from the political scene. So Arafat decided to sign the agreement, but on the same day that he signed the agreement, in fact a couple of hours after the ceremony in Washington, he broadcast to his own people through the Jordanian television, he told them, look, what we sign now is the implementation of the phase strategy of 1974. And he ended his speech, long live Palestine free and liberated. And of course when he talks about Palestine free and liberated, he doesn't talk about a part of Palestine free and liberated. He talks about the entire land, which doesn't include the state of Israel. And in the 10 years since then, Arafat has been on record numerous times telling these people that basically what they are doing is the first strategy. Now, of course, they have other catchphrases that they use. Many of them, when they speak on Western media outlets, for example, Western audiences don't see anything wrong with them, but to Palestinians and Arabs they are very clear. For example, when Palestinians and Arabs talk about the full legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, it means Palestine without Israel. Of course, when a Western person hears it, it's a full legitimate right, so okay, maybe a two-state solution, maybe side by side in peace and harmony, but not to the Palestinians. Another one is, for example, the liberation of Jerusalem. When Arafat talks about Jerusalem, he doesn't talk about East Jerusalem. He talks about Jerusalem in the Islamic and Arabic connotations. He fashions himself on Caliph Omar. Caliph Omar was the second in line of the successors of Prophet Muhammad and the person who occupied Palestine in 638 and occupied Jerusalem. And when Arafat talks about the liberation of Jerusalem, he fashions himself like Caliph Omar, or alternatively like Saladin, the ruler of Egypt, who defeated the Crusaders and captured Jerusalem. Or Arafat resorts occasionally to other Islamic metaphors. For example, I'm sure some of you remember that in May 1994, the 10th of May 1994, Arafat went to South Africa and spoke to a Muslim audience in a mosque. It was supposed to be a closed meeting, but it recorded without his knowledge. And in this meeting, he said two things. One, he said that basically what he was involved in, the so-called peace process, was a jihad against Israel, and he asked the support of the world Muslims in this jihad. The second thing is, which is even more serious, he compared the Oslo Accords to an agreement that Prophet Muhammad signed with the people of Mecca. Mecca was the hometown of Muhammad, and they forced him to flee, and he moved to Medina, and then later he occupied Mecca. But at a certain point he signed a peace agreement with these people, and he reneged on the agreement 2 years later when the situation changed. So what Arafat told these people, he said, this agreement, Hudaybiyah was the name of the place that it was signed, also is the Hudaybiyah agreement, which means that basically the agreement is signed for the short term and he's going to renege on it. Now these issues became public. They came in two installments. First came the issue of the jihad. And of course the Israeli government was incensed because a couple of weeks before this incident, Israel signed a second agreement with the PLO based on the 93 agreement, which allowed Arafat to come to Gaza and establish his authority. The Palestinian Authority was established in May 94. So 2 weeks after he signed the second agreement, Arafat basically said that this agreement didn't matter. So Rabin and Peres of course were incensed. Peres went to talk to Arafat. Arafat convinced him somehow that when he talks about jihad, he doesn't really mean any violence, because jihad in Muslim tradition is a personal struggle for self-improvement. So of course there is this element in jihad, I mean, in Islam, but nobody suspects that when the Ottoman Sultan declared jihad on the British in the First World War, he meant that the Muslims would sit home and ponder about theological questions. So, I mean, but Peres brought the argument, because in any case, in Peres' view, where did the decoration in the Arab world? So why would he not accept Arafat's explanation? Now came the Hudaybiyah, and the Hudaybiyah created an even bigger stir. Rabin told Arafat that if he didn't renege on this Hudaybiyah metaphor, the peace process is off. Even a person like Yossi Sarid, who is one of the most leftist of the Israeli cabinet at the time, said that if Arafat doesn't retract his words, he's going to end up as the mayor of Gaza. Okay, Arafat didn't retract his words. Not only did he did not retract them, but in fact 2 weeks later he reiterated them, this time in public to a Palestinian delegation that came to visit him, and in the next 10 years he repeated it on numerous occasions. So what I'm saying is that basically from 93 onwards, Arafat has been telling these people that Oslo is basically a grand deception. And then you have other people, I won't tire you with all of them. You have people like Nabil Shat, who is today the foreign minister, who was saying that so long as the Israelis give us what we want, so then we don't use violence. The moment they stop, then we use violence. And then the difference is that today we have a large Palestinian force of 30,000-40,000 people, which we didn't have before. You have the late Fatah Husseini, who compared Oslo to a Trojan horse, and so on and so forth. Including Yasser Abdrabo, the person who just signed the Geneva Agreement with Yossi Benin, on several occasions as well, said that basically the so-called peace process should lead to the liberation of complete Palestine. Then there was a number of other issues. One of them was the Palestinian Covenant, for example. When the PLO was established in 1964, there are two founding documents. One of them was the Palestinian Covenant, which is basically, according to their own definition, the Bible of the PLO. And the Palestinian Covenant is about 31 articles. About two-thirds of them deal with the destruction of Israel. In various terms, And as a precondition to the signing of the Oslo Accords, Rabin extracted, undertaken by Arafat in writing on the 9th of September 1993, that the covenant would be abolished by the Palestine National Council, which is the parliament of the PLO. Of course, Arafat did nothing of the sort, and once he signed the Oslo Accords, an elaborate cat and mouse game ensued. Arafat evaded his responsibilities every time Rabin and Peres came to him and asked, threatened, pleaded. He came with excuses. He said, I cannot, you know, I respect your democracy, you have to respect our democracy, was one argument. The other one was, Israel prevents members of the Palestine National Council from coming to the territory, so how can they shoot the boat? Of course, Israel did nothing of the sort, and so on and so forth. To cut a long story short, the covenant was not abolished. Shortly before, after Rabin's assassination, when Peres was the prime minister, shortly before the election, the PLO, the PNC convened and pretended to have abolished it with a view of helping Peres win the elections against Netanyahu. It didn't help, and it transpired later that basically it was a bluff. Then Netanyahu came, he pressured Arafat. Arafat didn't really give in. Eventually, they did some kind of substitute arrangement. President Clinton came to Gaza. They had some big ceremony and supposedly amended the covenant, but not according to the regulation and stipulations that they had to do. So in fact, they didn't do it. And the fact that they didn't do it was, of course, because the covenant is the essence of the PLO, and the PLO is an organization committed to the destruction of Israel. Now there is another issue, and this is, of course, the issue of education and incitement, if you like. In the various Oslo Accords, you have Palestinian and Israeli undertakings to prevent incitement, to educate to peace, and so on and so forth. And again, Arafat did nothing of the sort. On the contrary, he, you know, already on his welcome speech to Gaza, was a very inflammatory speech, despite the fact that President Mubarak turned it down. It used the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It approached the Israeli Arabs, not the Arabs in the territories, and promised them liberation from the Israeli occupation. Occupation meaning since 48, not since 67. And then, of course, once they gain control over their population, since 94, 95, 96, they incited them without any Israeli interruption. So if you follow Palestinian television, the radio, the newspapers, the books, high school textbooks, religious preachings, every Friday there is a sermon in the Muslim world, and they broadcast it on television. Live. I mean, this is a practice that is done in the entire Arab world. I remember even as a child I used to follow it in the Jordanian television. But of course, in the Jordanian television it was a Friday sermon and it didn't necessarily deal with the Jews. The sermons in the Palestinian Authority, so all of which are authorized by the Palestinian Authority, are mostly about the killing of Jews and the destruction of the state of Israel, and this is the situation that has been going on for 10 years. So you have all this volume of noises coming from the Palestinian territories, and the Israelis ignored it. I mean, it's a peril, of course, but it is. Now there is something even more serious, which is, of course, action, because you can say, okay, politicians speak, even in the West, they say something they don't always mean what they say. and they don't say what you mean. But if you see that there is a correlation between what you say and what you do, you assume that you mean what you do. And the best proof, of course, is the Palestinian behavior with regard to violence. The essence of the Oslo Accords was that violence is out of the Palestinian-Israeli relationship. Regardless or whatever differences they would have in the future, they would never result to violence. This is undertaking that Arafat again made in a letter to Rabin on 9th of September. It was in the Oslo Accord of September 93. It was in the follow-up agreement of 94, of 95, in 98 when Netanyahu was already in power. In fact, you have about 5 agreements in which the Palestinians committed themselves never to use violence, never to allow the existence of any armed militias in the territories, and so on and so forth. And of course, Arafat did nothing of the sort. Not only did he not disarm the various organizations, he established further organizations like the Tanzim, which is the military arm of Fatah, which is the main group of the PLO. And it was dormant since the early 90s, so he reestablished it and armed it in flagrant violation of the accord. He acquired weapons he was not supposed to do, and so on and so forth. And he turned a blind eye to Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorism, and when the moment came and the Israelis didn't do what he wanted them to do, as Nabil Shah said, he resorted to violence. If you recall, in 1996, in September, there was a mini war that lasted 3 or 4 days, because Israel opened an exit to an underground tunnel in Jerusalem. I mean, the tunnel existed for 2,000 years, and the other exit was open for a long time. Hundreds of thousands of tourists used the tunnel, but there was a problem because one exit was closed, and therefore the tourists had to go one way and come back. And it was a major loss to the local Arab merchants. So Israel opened this exit, and Arafat used it as a pretext for unleashing a tidal wave of violence, saying that Israel tried to undermine the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and so on and so forth. And about 85 Palestinians, and I don't remember the exact number, but close to 20 Israelis were killed, and dozens were wounded. And the sad thing is that basically Arafat came out on top, because people said to Netanyahu, how careless are, didn't you think that opening an exit could lead to a war? I mean, you know, it's obviously everyone in the world starts for, you know, some ancient tunnel that is open. And in fact, Arafat realized that using violence is successful, and there is ample evidence that from this time onward the EU was consistently preparing for the fight that would come at the end of the road, because he knew that Netanyahu wouldn't give him necessarily everything he wanted. And even after Netanyahu lost the elections, Barak would never been very excited about Oslo. I mean, Barak was opposed to Oslo when it was signed. He was the chief of staff. He told Rabin that the agreement was like Swiss cheese. It had so many holes. Then when he became cabinet minister in 95, he voted against the interim agreement of October 95, and Rabin was incensed because he brought Barak to government in order to reinforce his own position, because Barak was a mystery man. And Barak voted against him in 95. Then Barak came to power, and Barak said, I don't want to continue the graduated withdrawal, let's move immediately to the final status talks. And of course Arafat didn't like it, because Arafat's plan was to get Israel to withdraw from the entire territory, give it nothing in return, and then, you know, try to impose the right of return, which in Palestinian protection means the destruction of Israel, or other, you know, unacceptable conditions to Israel, and if Israel were not to accept it, then it would be war. And this is indeed what happened. Barak pushed Clinton to convince Camp David. Arafat didn't want to come to Camp David because he knew he wouldn't get from Barak what he expected. But Clinton insisted, so they all came. Barak and Camp David offered Arafat, according to the Palestinian accounts, not according to the Israeli accounts, 92% of the West Bank. The Gaza Strip was already under Palestinian control, with the exception of a few, you know, small settlements there. He offered the partition of Jerusalem, and he offered a quicker solution of the refugee problem, even though this remained, you know, untouched at the meeting. As we all know, Arafat left, rejected it, and if you follow again the Palestinian media, the Palestinian newspaper, I guess if you have better intelligence sources, you would realize that after Camp David, in fact, even before Camp David, the Palestinians intensified their preparation for war, and then when Sharon made his walk along, you know, to Temple Mount, Arafat used it to start the war. It's a pretext. Again, it works. And if you look at the media, you know, many people view Sharon's provocation as the cause of the war, which is, again, I mean, you know, in my view, it's patronizing. It's part of this Western tendency, which is very strong among Israelis and among many Westerners, to view Arab as some kind of half-wit creatures, you know, people who really don't know anything about their own good. I mean, you won't assume that you'll start a war, I don't know, if a Muslim would, you know, take a walk across a church in London, I don't think the United Kingdom is going to attack Egypt or whatever, if Mubarak will visit London and happen to be near St. Paul's or something. But of course, when it comes to the Muslims, so yes, if a person walks in a Jewish holy site, which happens to be a Muslim holy site as well, this is a casus belli. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the events more closely, you see that the war didn't start on Sharon's visit. Sharon visited on Thursday. On this day, despite very insistent incitement by the Palestinian Authority, by the Hamas, by the Fatah, who called the Palestinians to come and demonstrate, there was not really major clashes on Temple Mount. There was some stone throwing, nobody was killed, almost no Palestinians were wounded, far more Israeli policemen were wounded than Palestinians, and then it subsided. What happened is that the day later, which was the Friday, Arafat used the Friday sermons as a starting point for the war. They prepared the large stockpiles of rocks on Temple Mount, they brought their people there, there are scores of security, Palestinian security people there, to ensure that there were casualties, and indeed on the Friday there were casualties, and from then on the snowball started rolling. So it's very clear that Sharon's visit didn't trigger the war. And in fact, many Palestinians admitted it. You had senior Palestinian leaders like Marwan Barghouti, who is the head of the Tanzim, and the Tanzim carried out most of the war against Israel until Barghouti was caught in April 2002, and he's been ever since in Israeli jail. And Barghouti said, you know, a few months after the war started, he said, look, we knew already, you know, a few months before Camp David that September would be the deadline, because in September the Oslo, the timetable of the original Oslo Accords was supposed to expire. And then the Palestinians threatened to establish their state unilaterally. So he said, we knew that September would be the day, and we prepared for it, and we knew that we have to use violence because the Israelis don't understand any other language. And then Sharon came, and it fell into our legs. And it said Barghouti. And then you have other very senior people in the Palestinian leadership. Mamdouh Naufal, for example, who used to be a terrorist, responsible for some of the worst atrocities in the 70s, but he's also an intellectual. And he wrote a few books. He's very close to Arafat. And he said in a debate amongst Palestinians, he described it, he said, look, this so-called intifada has never been weapon-free, it was militarized from moment one, Arafat viewed it as, Sharon viewed it as a trigger to inflame the Israeli-Palestinian situation, and hopefully the entire Middle East, and so on and so forth. You have Fatah Husseini, and you have quite a few others that admitted it. So we know that basically Sharon viewed it was a pretext. The question is, of course, what is it all about? So So first of all, it's not an intifada. I mean, I think the first Palestinian propaganda gain is that they managed to insert the term the second intifada to world public opinion. Intifada is an uprising. This is not an uprising. This is not an uprising for a number of reasons. First of all, there was no Israeli occupation at the time of the intifada, of the so-called intifada. Because Israel relinquished control over the population in the West Bank in early 96, and definitely since 97, when it redeployed from Hebron. And the population in Gaza has been under Palestinian control. So 99% of the Palestinians in the territory is under Palestinian control since 1996. And in fact, it's the removal of the Israeli occupation that allowed Arafat to prepare the war with impunity. So of course Israel still controls about 60% of the West Bank, but these are empty territories, it's not populated areas. And these are disputed territories that the future of which had to be agreed in negotiations. So there was no occupation that didn't revolt against Israel. The second thing is that the population didn't rise against Israel. It was an orchestrated war by Arafat. The people didn't have an interest in rising against or going to war. I mean, it was the worst time from the Palestinian point of view. If you remember, during the Rabin Peres prime ministership, there was quite a few suicide bombings. So Israel steals the territories. Since Israel steals the territories, Palestinians couldn't come to work in Israel. Therefore, the standard of living dropped significantly. Ken Netanyahu, and under Netanyahu, for one reason or another, terrorism subsided. And therefore the territories were gradually reopened and the standard of living was going up. So the Palestinians were, as a matter of fact, in 1999 and 2000, in the midst of a healthy economic recovery after years of economic depression. So the last thing on their mind was to go to war. And in fact, when Arafat came from Camp David, despite all his efforts, he didn't manage to get more than 200 or 300 people to demonstrate in Ramallah against Barak's intransigence in Camp David. There was even a more revealing episode. After Camp David, the Arab residents of Jerusalem got alarmed lest Israel would give East Jerusalem to the PLO. And then they thought, what would happen? We lose all the social and the economic benefits that we have as a result of being part of Israel today. And Faisal Husseini called the heads of the chief editors of the Palestinian newspapers and he reassured them that regardless of whatever solution there would be for Jerusalem, these people wouldn't lose the Israeli social benefits. So these people didn't have any interest in an uprising. This was not an uprising. This was a deliberate war of terror. And if you look at the way that the Palestinian media, Palestinian press, television, statements, present their objectives, it's the same objective. This is a war, as they call it, the war of liberation and return. Return again. Return in their perception is return to where they left in 48, with the implication of the destruction of the state of Israel. And then you have all the religious sermons calling for the Israeli destruction. You have statements by Palestinian leaders and so on and so forth. So in fact the war is of course not about the West Bank and Gaza, but about the destruction of the state of Israel, which of course leads us to the final issue, which is so how do we get out of here? I don't know. One thing I know for sure, so long as Arafat and the PLO are there, Israel is not going to get out of it, because the PLO and Arafat are still committed to the destruction of the state of Israel. And it's not only the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, it's not, you know, like many times Israeli side on the Israeli side and the Arab side, we have our extremists and you have your extremists. That's not the issue. The issue is the mainstream body of Palestinian politics, which is the PLO, is still committed to the destruction of the state of Israel, regardless of the many agreements it signed with Israel. And therefore, I personally don't see any solution without the destruction of the PLO. I mean, Israel has to go and remove Arafat and the people that he brought from Tunis, I don't know, the 20,000-30,000 of them out of the territories, and then do what Yossi Begin suggested in 1993, reoccupy the territory and disarm the Hamas, and then try to do in Israel what the United States is trying to do in Iraq, and so far with no much success, bring up a new leadership that will hopefully be more amenable to peace. This will take time, I know, and in the meantime, it was just to persevere and continue the struggle.
Okay, so I think I'll stop and maybe we can have questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kors, for your great analysis of what's happening today. Let's open up the floor for a few questions.
In the left in Israel resonates with the left in Europe, and also resonates with many in the left in the United States. But what if the left were to come to power in the United States? Is that any danger to Israel?
I guess these are issues that you are no less informed than I am. I'm just following the candidates now, you know, I came to Harvard, all of them, Hard Rock, and I saw Dean the other day, I wasn't that impressed, but according to what you hear, it definitely will be far less positive than Bush. The fact of the matter is that even President Bush, you know, is not 100% consistent. I mean, in June 2002, President Bush basically outlined his vision for peace. And he said the Palestinians should have a new leadership, untainted by terrorism. And then, of course, we will help you to reach a two-state solution. But at a certain point on the way, he gave up the idea of a new Palestinian leadership, and he's trying to find some easy ways around, like he endorsed Abu Mazen at a certain point. Abu Mazen is part of the same group, so maybe he has less blood on his hands than Arafat, but it's like the classic Hitler with Himmler. And in the final account, Abu Mazen disappeared because Arafat wouldn't allow anyone else. And today we have Abu Allah. I think we have to go back to what Bush said. You have to have a new leadership without this. Maybe that's afterthought on what you asked at the beginning. Look, my view on the panel account is that in the Middle East, the main impetus for Middle Eastern development comes from the inside, not the outside. And the Great South can be influential, but in the panel account, they cannot do very much. I mean, okay, he went to war against Iraq and he destroyed Saddam Hussein, which of course is exceptional and it wasn't done before, and this is why Saddam is calculated. But look, Arafat is there, he has been now encircled in a small compound, the Mukatara, as it's called in Arabic, for, I don't know, more than a year. Israel can kill him any day, can remove him any day, and nobody is allowed to touch him. He sits there, he undermines from this small building Bush's policy. Bush endorsed the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority. Arafat undermined him. And Arafat will undermine any solution that America will try to impose, so long as he doesn't like it. So in this respect, it matters less what kind of president will be. Of course, regarding Israel, it's more dangerous, because Israel is the only democracy, it's a small country, vulnerable society, is more susceptible to pressure. And then, you know, a president who is hostile, let's say, or less favorable to Israel can cause damage. But in the panel account, you know, if it will come, you know, to the last resort, I think even Israel will say no to an American president. I mean, Ben-Gurion did it in 48. I mean, Truman didn't want the establishment of the state of Israel when it was established, and Ben-Gurion went ahead and established it. And I agree with you. I mean, that's the strategy of Oslo, in a way. Look, there's been a big debate, I mean, when a Palestinian nation has come into existence, and you have this debate, and, you know, everyone remembers that Golda Meir supposedly said there is no Palestinian people, even though Golda Meir referred to the beginning of the century. But even Security Council Resolution 242 of 67 doesn't mention the word Palestinians. Nobody thought there was Palestinian people at the time. So it's not only Golda Meir, and so on. And the fact of the matter is that since 48 you had in fact several, or more than several Palestinian communities. So you had the people in the West Bank, more or less, the people in Gaza. Then you had the diaspora, and the diaspora is diverse. Even in Gaza it's diverse. They are still socially constructed along the lines that, that existed before 48. So let's say the people who arrived from, I don't know, from Haifa area, they live together and they interact less with others. So Palestinian society even today is not, you know, a full-fledged nation. So what I'm saying is that when Israel occupied the territories in 67, basically there was a big divide between what the Palestinians called the outside and the inside. And I think Israel had a historic chance at the time to move the people in the West Bank and Gaza more actively towards creating their own leadership, which I think might have accepted a state within the these territories and converted to Israel. Israel unfortunately didn't do it. You know, Moshe Dayan and others, I mean, a bit laid-back approach. They suppressed terrorism, so there was no terrorism, they were happy. But then they allowed the PLO to penetrate, and the PLO started gaining control over this territory. But still, there was a difference. And even after Arafat came, by the way, there was a big resentment in the territories against the PA rule because of the corruption, because they disliked the idea that people come from the outside and get the top jobs and you know, tell them what to do and so on and so forth. So I think the basis is there, and the strategy of Oslo is that Arafat poisoned these people now for 10 years, and the population that was basically better disposed to an agreement today is much less disposed, because 10 years is a long time. If you're a young kid, age of 5, and you get 10 years of incitement, you're 15 already, you are a lost kid. So I agree, it may take a generation. But I disagree with the view that you cannot impose. I mean, what are you doing in Iraq now? Basically, what did the West do in Germany after the Second World War? They didn't leave it to the Germans to re-educate their society. So I don't say that you have to rewrite their books, but you can, you know, you can supervise it in such a way to ensure that, you know, they don't teach them the way that they used to teach them, and hopefully within a generation, hopefully we survive this generation. That's what you mean.
Thanks. Thank you for having me for American household and presenting your crystal clear vision of what's happening. How do we analyze the media?
I mean, I'm not a media person, but I mean, I think, you see, I mean, it goes back to the problem of Jews. You have two people, you have three opinions, and then you have a clash of egos, and the foreign ministry doesn't want anyone else to do it, and the fight with the IDF, with Tzal, over certain issues, like, you know, when there was the Jenin issue, I think, because of squabbling, Israel didn't get the message across. And on the whole, again, it goes back maybe to the diaspora existence. The Jews always were suppressed, or they had to outsmart the rulers. Israel is a bit anarchic way of government. You see, you have ministers sitting in cabinet, coming out and, you know, writing in the media against the prime minister and so on and so forth. And it never happens in Western society. So first of all, Israel has to speak in one voice. They have to agree on the lines. They have to concentrate the effort. In my view, they have to establish a ministry of information that will take care of it and coordinate the various advocacy organizations around the world. And they have to, obviously, to get right people to do it. And then they have to take certain messages, in my view, and hammer them time and again. You know, not only through talks, I mean, through commercials even, through, I don't know if you can have an exodus today, like movie about the plight of Israel today. It's more likely to do another kind of movie there. But if you could do it. And then I think it can start thinking, because you see the Palestinians have a few catchphrases, like occupation. You know, you have occupation, so it justifies everything. And if you show that basically there is no occupation, and that they basically don't suffer, even when there was occupation, and so on and so forth, so I think people will start thinking. Or Resolution 242, isn't that Israel, you know, Israel is a violation of UN resolutions. You had an article this week in London, I don't know if you noticed, a guy called Gerald Kaufman, Jewish, as you can imagine, was supposed to be the foreign minister of the Labour, but Blair doesn't like him, thanks God, so he keeps him out of politics. So he wrote an article in England this week in The Spectator, which is a right-wing magazine,
And he said, why doesn't the United States invade Israel? Israel violates UN resolutions, Israel is not better than Iraq, and so on and so forth. So you see all these notions, and of course they have nothing to do with reality, and you have in my view, in a simple way even, you know, not sophisticated, but, you know, very simple and straightforward, even appeal to the gut reaction of people, convince them that Israel is not violating resolution, it is not occupying, and so on and so forth. I mean, I was not...
The question was about fence, of the wall dividing, is that changing the reality of what's taking place today?
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, it's a fence, it's not a wall. I mean, wall you have only around 5% of the... Oh, that's the reality. But the point is that the media focuses on this 5% and they present it all the time, so that idea of the wall. I mean, I personally didn't speak, you see... The idea of a fence is a leftist idea, it's not the idea of the right wing. Rabin, the first time I saw Rabin referring to it, he might have done it this earlier, but the first time I documented it is January 95 after one major suicide bombing. He said he's going to erect a fence, not along the 67 border. So this is Rabin's idea, and then Barak came and Barak adopted. The right wing was not happy with it because, you know, in a way, when you have a line, so you separate effectively the territories, and the territories east of the line are lost. And this is the reason that the fence does exist, because if Sharon was committed to erecting it, it would be standing in line. Sharon is not a person who is sitting on his hands when he wants. So I think on the whole, the fence will allow at a tactical level. It will prevent a certain amount of suicide bombing, and if you say, I don't know, if you doesn't like the year, I think it's a lot. I mean, you know, we have families in Israel, you know. Eventually, it strikes at every family sooner or later. I mean, it's random, but it affects eventually everyone. So if you can save lives. On the other hand, I don't think you should disillusion yourself that if you have a wall, it will prevent terrorism completely. Especially if you have a Palestinian state, and if the state is not civilized, you know, you can shoot on top of the wall. And if you have a Palestinian state, you have Katyushas falling on Tel Aviv on a regular basis, and so on and so forth. So on the whole, the wall is far less critical than the media is making an issue, and it's making an issue because the Palestinians don't want it. They don't want it because they want to continue killing Israelis as we, because the fence set a political fence because it runs east of the 67 border, and therefore it indicates that the Palestinians are not going to get the entire territory. And there is the economic consideration as well, and people don't talk about it, but you know, and you know, I don't want to sound racist or something, but the Palestinians have been stealing from Israel on a major, on a national scale. I mean, Israel was number one in the world in carpets until Arafat started his war 3 years ago. It's about $1 billion per year. And I don't think Israel has to finance the Palestinian Authority to the tune of $1 to $2 billion a year in foreign currency, because Israel, you know, people said, okay, the insurance pays for your car so the people don't suffer, but the state suffers because it has to import new cars. So I think if Arafat wants to have a new car, he should buy it, not steal it from Israel. And this is another reason for the fence. Yeah.
Your idea for potential solution is for the elimination of Arafat, the reoccupation, full reoccupation of the territory over there, and an attempt to re-educate the population to help build and foster a leadership from within that will be more amenable to living with Israel. Now, if I'm understanding correctly, then that is your, you know, say solution or your vision. I mean, my question is this. To do such a thing would call out vilification further than Israel already has from the rest of the world. But vilification, people say, listen, if they were to take the step and you say over here, do you perceive possibly a war again in neighboring Arab states? And if not, then what do you think would be the dire consequences of taking this action, which might finally end this
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a difficult question. I mean,
it might come as a surprise to some of the listeners, but I view myself in mainstream Zionism, and mainstream Zionism accepted two-state solution a long time ago. So obviously, you know, even if you re-educate a Palestinian, you re-educate them with a view of eventually being able to survive in a state. So in this respect, what Bush, the Bush vision of June, you know, I could live with it, provided the Palestinians were willing to live with this agreement. And the problem is that the Israelis, most Israelis, even today, even Ariel Sharon basically accepted two state solutions. Sharon said that the Palestinian state would be established. He talks about personal concessions. So Israelis accept the idea. The problem is that the Arabs have never accepted it today. And you have to educate them in this direction. Now, I think it will be extremely difficult politically to do what I'm suggesting. I mean, if the United States stood unequivocally behind Israel, I think Israel could have done it quite quickly and finished off the war within weeks. I don't think it would take much more. Look what happened in April 2002. Israel went in and within a week, basically terrorism went down to zero. And then later on, Israel started releasing the pressure and so on and so forth, so it started coming back. But the United States to stand behind it, and okay, it will be the Bush administration, hopefully in the second term, hopefully Bush could be convinced that this is a precondition to his own vision. The Europeans will not support in any case. Now, the Arabs don't care about the Palestinians. I mean, they never did, and the Palestinians know it, the Arabs know it. You know, and if you look at Palestinian writings, for example, in 48, 49, 50, even PL Fatah, which is the organization that Arafat established, that eventually took over the PLO. In the 60s, they blamed the Arabs for the disaster of 48, not Israel. Even a person like Nasser that made a career out of bashing Israel, didn't view Israel as responsible for 48. When he spoke, you know, to American diplomats, the British, he viewed the British as responsible, the Arab leaders. Arabs never did anything to help the Palestinians. They do it because of their own consideration. So I don't think they'll go to war against Israel. If they'll go to war, they'll go to war for their own reasons. If Mubarak will decide, I don't know, that he had domestic problems, he wants to take off the pressure, the religious militants are going, you know, are getting too powerful in Egypt, he might go to war, but never on behalf of the Palestinians. That's a big question. I mean, obviously, I don't think Israel will do it. That's the point. You need a Ben-Gurion to do it. As I said before, in 48, Ben-Gurion went against the administration. If you read the New York Times, you have a title, I thought, you know, quite revealing. It said, Ben-Gurion to declare a state against the view of America. Sharon's policy is to go hand in hand with Bush. I don't think Sharon will do it, and I definitely don't think people like Netanyahu or others can do it. So I don't think it's realistic, but again, it will be a major, you know, 9/11 in Israel, and 3,000 Israelis will be killed, which is, of course, a much higher proportionally. Then I think Arafat was lashing the territories for more than a few hours, and so on.
We have time for two more questions, so one over there. Stand up.
You know, the job of the military is to find solutions to military problems. And if this general thinks there is no military solution, as some of them say, he should resign and take a job in Kukat Kolim, I don't know, you know, the health services. Labor Party dominated Israel for so long before the state was established. And even when Likud came to power in 77, they didn't manage to put their people, they didn't have enough people to put them to start with, and they didn't manage to institutionalize their own people in many parts of the state apparatus, and even today, even the Foreign Office. You know, I just talked the other day to an American professor, and he spoke to some Israeli diplomats, and said, why don't you do this?
or that, he said, how can we? Israel is doing terrible things, and this is Israeli diplomat. So, I mean, the leftists are in the Israeli foreign office as well, and many of them are in the army. This head of Shabak, I mean, I don't know. I don't have words to describe. I read this interview in full. I don't know how it was translated because it's damaging. My only, exasperation was that these people were in such a position of influence for so many years. So something must be wrong with the system. Their thinking is so shallow. So, you know, even my children, when they're 1 or 2 years old, they knew that if they put their hand in the electricity, they get a shock. You have cause and effect in life. These people never ask, why are we in the situation that we are? How come that there is war going on? If you want, find a solution. I mean, you have just to understand the root causes and then you find a solution. So it's extremely disappointing, yeah.
Last question. Yep.
Since we think that the Palestinians have not been required to follow through on any of their promises, which are stopping terrorism, but we have the roadmap and we're now sort of pretty close to the Geneva Protocol so much further. The roadmap says there will be a Palestinian state in 2005, and they're supposed to stop the terrorism report, but we haven't heard them for that.
You know what they say in Hebrew, that since the destruction of the temple, the prophecy was given to fools. So I used to have an intelligence when I was young, so this was our job, and then you see how many mistakes we did. You know, we didn't anticipate any major development, we didn't anticipate Oslo either, so. I mean, that's the great fear. I mean, you know, that's the great fear. That, because Bush already reneged on what he said in 2002. I mean, the roadmap is already the illusion of his pledge for new Palestinian leadership. I mean, this is something that Israel will have to find, tooth and nail. And even, you know, if they need a V, you know, go against the United States. Because the Palestinian state, that is not, you know, a civilized, quote-unquote, state, I mean, it's going to be impossible for Israel to deal with. What we have today is a kid in kindergarten game compared to the terrorism that will ensue then, because you will have, you don't have to be a big genius to realize that they'll import all kinds of weapon systems that can terrorize Israel. They'll have all kinds of Hezbollah, Hamas, Iranians, I don't know, Qaeda types, roaming their territories, and Israel is so small, so. Yeah, and therefore I think it's only Israel and the United States can do something to block it, and you know, the Democratic leader, candidate at the moment, I don't see anyone that is really, I can rely on. President Bush, hopefully, I don't know, will get the good advice, the right advice during this period when this issue will become relevant. Because I'm sure, like you said, that the State Department will say, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, they did this here, they didn't kill Israel for 3 days, so it's a major development and so on. I think the strategy of Oslo again is that Oslo brought Israel to square one. I mean, Israel is today fighting for its life, and 10 years ago it was not. I mean, when Israel signed Oslo, Israel was in a very good position. It was economically, militarily, politically sound. And then it signed Oslo, and look where we are today.
Fortunately, our time is up. I'd like to thank Dr. Karsh for his in-depth analysis of the situation. It's really important to hear. And also, I'd like to thank Bob Guzzardi for having this lecture. I think we all appreciate that he brought such a great scholar to talk to us. If anybody wants to purchase Dr. Karsh's book, there will be a sign-up sheet over there, and they'll be able to order signed copies of his book. And I thank you all for coming tonight.